Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. This is Frank McKay, but more importantly, my very special guest is his honor, and he will always have that title, Rudy Giuliani. Your honor, how are you?
I am fine, Frank. Good to talk to you. It's been a while.
Yes, well, thank you very much, and we appreciate having you. Let me just bring this up, and all New Yorkers feel this way about, and again, by no means are we comparing a sporting event to what happened with our city and with our world on 9/11, but New Yorkers more than anyone appreciate individuals who step up in a big moment. I can't imagine a bigger moment that could have occurred than 9/11. And I mean, it's just one of these things that you'll always be remembered for. You'll always be loved for. And, you know, as far as that goes, I can't think of a historical equivalent. I mean, can you put it in perspective?
I don't think I really can completely, Frank. I tried to in my book, but that was just a few months after it was over. Maybe someday I'll write another one and with the perspective of 15, 20 years of looking back on it. It was the worst attack in the history of my city, my country, I guess since the War of 1812. I think very, very fortunate to have unbelievable first responders. You know, really just, you know them and I know them. A lot of them live all over, not just in New York City, but in Nassau and Suffolk and Westchester and firefighters, police officers, rescue workers. They saved thousands of lives. The 9/11 Commission estimates that the fire department and the police department saved 98% of the people they were capable of saving. And I know this because Chief Gansey, when I first got there, told me they couldn't save the people at the top of the building because they couldn't get the firefighters up there because there was fire in between, and they couldn't get a helicopter up there. So I think that the inherent bravery of our American people just kind of welled up, and they were able to handle it and show the terrorists that they can't stop us.
Who explained, I'm sure you've answered this question a million times, but just for our listeners, who explained the situation to you as it first came to you, as it first happened, and how soon did it take for you to all understand exactly what was going on?
That's a very good question. So when I first found out about it, I was sitting at a hotel having breakfast with two people on 55th Street. And police officer and the two people were my counsel and Bill Simon. And one of my police officers came in and told me that there was a fire at the World Trade Center and that a twin engine plane had hit, I think she said, the North Tower. And she said the fire is pretty bad. So we got up immediately, got in my car, and we started driving toward there, and I could see all the flames. I could see how bad it was. I realized it wasn't an accident because the sky was beautiful blue. It was a beautiful day. So there was no way that there was some kind of accident. So first two thoughts in my mind were terrorist attack or a crazy person that was attacking the building. Now, remember, we were ready for an Islamic extremist terrorist attack. We had had one in 1993. Wasn't the first time that these people tried to come and kill us. I had been investigating and prosecuting Islamic terrorism since 1975. I investigated Yasser Arafat. So I was a person who had a great deal of knowledge about Islamic terrorism from a prosecutor's point of view. And also, all during the time I was mayor, I was constantly being warned of terrorist attacks by the FBI, by the Joint Terrorism Task Force, by my police commissioner. We stopped one that was intended for a subway station in Brooklyn. We stopped a few that people never even heard about. So immediately the thought of an Islamic terrorist attack and Al-Qaeda entered my head. But I wasn't sure until the second plane hit that it was definitely a terrorist attack. I mean, there was always the chance that it could be a pilot that went crazy but when the second plane hit, obviously then it was a terrorist attack, and I knew who would be responsible. After all, bin Laden had declared war on America like 2 years earlier. he had attacked the USS Cole and killed our sailors, and President Clinton did nothing in response to that. I have been warning for years that our taking a peace dividend and reducing our military was putting us at risk of attack by people who hate us. And, you know, it was a worse attack than I expected, I have to tell you that. Yeah. We expected like suicide bombings like they had in Israel. We never expected what happened. It was just way beyond anything that we had imagined.
Let me remind everyone who just may be tuning in, or that if they're just turning on their radio, that this is Frank McKay, but you're hearing the voice of Rudy Giuliani, his honor, Mayor Rudy Giuliani. And prior to him being elected twice in New York City as a Republican, by the way, which is not easy to do, he was a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District. And you made quite a name for yourself there, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Gotti task force that was under your purview, was it?
It was, and I have to say, it was the Southern District.
Oh, Southern. I'm sorry.
Otherwise, I'd get really. All my former assistants who we just had a reunion with would get angry at me.
Yeah.
And we had prosecuted the five families of the mafia, the commission of the mafia. We had prosecuted the Peace of Connection case, which were the Sicilian mafia people who had infiltrated America. But we also had prosecuted terrorist cases. I had investigated, yes, Arafat's murder of Leon Klinghoffer. Mm. We prosecuted Wall Street people, Milken, Boesky. So, my background really was as an investigator and prosecutor, not as a political person. I had to learn that kind of on the job.
If you had to think back, and I'm sure you've thought about this at least some of the time, if you had to think back to when you first took over in the Southern District, where do you think at that moment you would have gone? Did you think politics? Were you thinking what? What were you thinking about?
Probably at that point I had, for the first year or so, I probably was thinking nothing because it was the only job I ever wanted. When I became U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, everybody has a goal in life. You want to be this, you want to be that, you want to be this. I wanted to be the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. So I wasn't thinking about running for office. It wasn't until after I became famous, right? When I famous, somewhat famous, and after the prosecution of the people in the Koch administration, the Parking Violations Bureau case, Donald Mattis, Stanley Friedman, the commissioner of the Parking Violations Bureau. It wasn't until after that I first thought about running for office, because my name recognition went from something like, you know, 50% to 90%. And I talked briefly about running for the Senate against Senator Moynihan, talked to Senator D'Amato about that and other people, and decided number one, I didn't want to run because I actually liked Senator Moynihan, so it would have been hard to run against him. Number two, I still had to finish two cases that I didn't want to leave hanging. So I stayed an extra year, and the thing that opened up was mayor. And I wasn't thinking about it all that much, a little bit. And Guy Molinari appears on television about the week after George Bush is elected president from being vice president. And he's on the Gay Pressman show. And Pressman says, you know, how come you Republicans never run anybody for mayor? The last one you ran got only 8%, and it's ridiculous. Kosh should get some competition. And Guy Molinari never calls me, doesn't ask me, says, I think Rudy Giuliani should run.
Mm. Wow.
I think he'd be a great candidate. He's a Republican, and look what he did for the city. And all of a sudden, I get 100 phone calls, and somebody accuses me of orchestrating it because he can't do that. And I called Guy up. I said, Guy, what the hell did you do that for? He said, because I wanted to kick you in the ass. That's why.
Wow. Yeah.
I wanted to kick you in the ass and get you to run. And so then about a month, 2 months later, I resigned as U.S. attorney. I ran the first time. I lost. David Dinkins won. The city got worse in every respect, including two major riots, one in Crown Heights, which was basically a pogrom against Jewish people, and one in Washington Heights over a big mistake where a police officer acted perfectly correctly in killing a drug dealer who was trying to kill him. But for 4 days, they made it appear as if the drug dealer was an altar boy. And they started burning buildings and throwing rocks at firefighters. We had the Korean boycott. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
We had 2 years under Dinkins in which we had 2,200 murders. You know, we lost more people under Dinkins than we did in the Afghan and Iraq wars combined.
Wow.
So I said, okay. I think maybe the city needs me. The second time around, I said, I got to 47% the first time, or 48, I don't remember. It was the highest percentage a Republican had gotten since LaGuardia.
It was shocking, actually. It was shocking.
When Lindsey ran, he won by 42 and 43%. Because remember, there were the three-way races where Buckley ran once and somebody else ran another time. So he never got a majority. And I said, gee, if with this bad record, I should be able to beat Dinkins. So I did, and then I won by only 3%, and then I won by 18. Wow. And
wow,
that's how it happened.
Yeah, it's a historic career, and you know, starting with the U.S. Attorney's Office, that's an amazing amount of accomplishments, actually. And you really don't remember too many U.S. attorneys other than Rudy Giuliani, and that's who we're speaking with right now. And this is Frank McKay. I have the honor of speaking to his honor, Mayor Giuliani. Now, when you first get elected, do you have a set plan going in?
Yeah, I did. I did. And here's the interesting thing. My good friend and campaign manager and my first deputy mayor during the beginning of my campaign, who you know very well, I think, Peter Powers, said to me just the other day, it's better you lost the first time. And I said, why, Peter? It's never nice to lose. He said, because you learn more by losing than winning. Because then when I decided I was going to run again after 2 years of being in private law practice, I sat down and I put together a small group of people, and every week on a Monday night, I would have an expert come in, and we would talk about how we would play make-believe. If I were the mayor, what would I do to straighten out taxes? What would I do to straighten out the economy? What would I do to straighten out welfare? What would I do to straighten out crime? What would I do about straightening out transportation? And we went through about 26, 27 of these sessions, developed a lot of ideas, most of which we couldn't use during the campaign because, you know, like campaigns, if you get two or three ideas across, it's a lot.
Yeah.
We would put out position papers and the press's eyes would glaze over, right?
Yeah, but what an idea. What a great idea to do this make-believe. You know, what if? What if? What would I do?
So what I did was I hired the guy who I already had hired him to be sort of like the clerk to take care of all this, to write it all up, Richard Schwartz. I hired him as my special assistant at City Hall. And he had all our plans, and his job was to make sure we didn't get distracted from our plans to reduce crime, to focus on domestic violence, eventually to put in a CompStat system, broken window theory. Welfare, our plan was dramatic, and people don't even remember this. This was before welfare reform. Number one, we fingerprinted every welfare recipient to make sure that they weren't double-dipping, because a lot of them were collecting welfare two and three times. The second thing we did is we required every welfare recipient to work 18 hours a week for the city if they were able-bodied.
Wow.
If you said you couldn't find a job, I would say, I have a job for you. Central Park is dirty. We got to clean it up. Our sanitation trucks need to be cleaned. You got to clean them. We need a lot of filing in the Department of Transportation. There's stuff there that hasn't been filed for 3 months. We have a backlog in mammograms. You can go help the city hospital expedite that. Now, that cost money. I had to put together like a staff that managed them. But my objective was to kind of restore the work ethic for them. These are people who have been getting money, not going to work. Some of them, as you remember, in the second generation, third generation. In other words, you had a lot of children in New York City that were living in families where nobody got up in the morning and went to work. So how the heck do you learn the work ethic? So I made them work, and then I paid my welfare workers bonuses for finding jobs for them. If you could find them a job, like with a local grocery store or the local hardware store or any job, you got a bonus as a welfare worker. And in the long run, we got 500,000+ people off welfare. And most of them were jobs. And that's probably the thing that I did that people don't realize helped keep crime down.
In put addition people to work.
What we did with the police department. Yes. In other words, by the time I left, a lot more, the unemployment had gone from 10% to like 6%. So that's a very different city. And then Mike did a terrific job of carrying on all those programs. And as I often say, in many cases, because of his business background, Mike Bloomberg, I'm talking about,
he added
things to them that made them better. So I see it as a 20-year almost continuum where I started it. I made I sort of moved the ship in the right direction, and then he got it sailing in that direction even better. I often joke and say I was the first Republican elected mayor in 25 years, and I was the first one to remain Republican in 50. Because Lindsay changed to Democrat and Mike changed to Independent.
That's true.
So I get from Republican audiences, I get a nice applause for that.
Are you living in New York? Are you living in the city?
I live in the city. I'm a constituent of the mayor. I was so happy during the 12 years of Burke. I thought I was going to feel a certain amount of dejection and depression and, you know, down and out. And when I left being mayor, and I started a business right away, then another one. Since I left being mayor, I have traveled to 80 countries.
Wow.
80.
Jeez.
And I've had an exciting life.
Yeah.
Mike made me feel good. I would come home to New York. I'd ask people how things are going, and some of them feel bad because they think it'd be, you know, they'd be upset. Oh, you were a better mayor, but Mike's doing a good job. I'd say, come on, how's he doing? He's doing a great job. I said, fine. You know something? I'd rather he do a better job than me, and then the next guy do a better job than me, than Mike, and the next guy do a better job than that guy. That's the way it should go in government. We should all try to make the city better. And so it was 12 great years of being able to not feel any remorse at not being mayor any longer. Kelly did a great job as police commissioner. Couldn't have done any better. I mean, there's nothing I could have done that he didn't do, and he probably did more. And then we get a return to what I regard as a form of socialism.
Mm. Yeah, I mean it's bizarre when you come into from the Queens Midtown Tunnel. Almost certainly you're gonna run into a squeegee man. I haven't seen one in 20 years.
You're gonna see dirt. I learned a lesson. Here's the problem, and this is, I'm gonna try to say this nicely.
Sure.
Like you have to make a payroll, and you are accountable, and you have goals that you have to meet, and you got to go to court and win your cases, because if you lose the cases, you get fired. I had some really tough jobs before I was mayor. Mike Bloomberg built one of the world's biggest businesses. In doing that, you learn how to manage. You learn how to run things. When you do this community organized political stuff, you don't. You learn platitudes.
Yeah.
But you don't really learn how to manage. And I think that is showing through in the city and in the country.
Do you think there'll ever be a report, and any time in the near future, there'll be a pro-choice Republican nominee? I mean, obviously.
Yes, I think there will be, as the issue becomes more and more something the president can't do anything about. And particularly as we compromise more, and the people who are very few people except extreme liberals are completely pro-choice.
Yeah, right.
Most people are against abortion. And then you start to get exceptions. They're against abortion, but they would allow it for rape, incest, or death of the mother. So you get that group. Then you'll get a group that's against abortion, but they would allow a woman in the first trimester to make that decision before the fetus becomes in any way viable. Very few people want to see the destruction of a viable fetus. And I think that's where we're going to end up, because since Roe against Wade was decided, which basically says you can't destroy a viable fetus, the time change has altered dramatically. In other words, we now realize that a fetus is viable at a much earlier stage than we did when Justice Blackmun decided that case. And I think basically the woman should have a choice, but that choice should be exercised in the first 3 months. And once that 3 months goes by, or 4 months, I'm not exactly sure, when you posit viability, then there should no longer be an abortion. Because now you're talking about a human being. But that's my view, and if I recall my theology correctly, that may actually be the view of Thomas Aquinas as to when the soul enters the body, but you don't want to get into theology.
I almost became
a priest, so that's very dangerous.
Yeah, well, and very dangerous. Let me ask you something about, it always stuck with me after I heard you say it. You said your father taught you that in a time of crisis, get yourself to get calmer and calmer.
You're right. Yeah. Absolutely right, Frank. I don't know why. I have no idea why. Maybe because he was teaching me to be a boxer. My father's dream for me was he wanted to be a judge. My father died before I ran for mayor, and my father died actually just as I was being confirmed as associate attorney general by the Senate. Mm. In fact, he died two days before I got confirmed. And he always would warn me about politics. He said, oh, politics is dirty and this and that. And he didn't like it. You should be a judge. Always wanted me to be a judge. But before that, he wanted me to be a boxer. And he used to teach me this lesson. He said, when things go wrong, but he would say it this way. If you're in a fire, become calm. Because if you remain calm, you'll be able to figure, is there a way out? And what's the best way out? But if you get nervous, you start to get all upset and you can't think straight and you can't focus on the best way out. And he said it, and then he would say, and if you're not calm, pretend you are. Just make believe you're calm. And it'll make you calm. And during September 11, particularly that first 3 or 4 days, I must have said that to myself 100 times. Someone would come up to me and tell me that Father Michael Judge was dead, who I was very close to. Mm. And ordinarily, I would go in the bathroom and cry, you know, if that had happened under ordinary circumstances. Instead, I said to myself, remain calm. I know I'm not calm, but I'm going to pretend I am. Mm. So all these other people remain calm. And that was a great lesson. And I try to teach that to my kids and to people who want to hear it.
Let me, you mentioned kids. Would you want your kids to go into politics?
I would. I grew up in the 50s and 60s when politics was an honorable thing to do. It still is an honorable thing to do. I think the idea that all politicians is corrupt is no more valid than all doctors are corrupt or all lawyers are corrupt or all politicians are corrupt or all priests are bad. Or it's an overstatement. The percentage of people in politics that are corrupt is about the percentage of people that are corrupt in society. That, by the way, that comes from a prosecutor who spent 17 years prosecuting, and I never found that any profession had a monopoly on virtue or vice. I think politicians at their best are wonderful because they help people. I look at what Ronald Reagan did. I don't know where America would be without Ronald Reagan.
I agree with you there, 100%.
I thank God for George Bush when September 11 happened, because I don't know where we would be if we had elected Gore. Yeah. And we certainly wouldn't have struck back against Afghanistan in the way we did. And we would have had other attacks in New York if we didn't do that. He went right on the offense. He didn't let the USS Cole get have our sailors killed and not do anything. He hit them so hard that, you know, they were hiding in the caves, so they couldn't come here and kill us. Mm. So people make a difference. So when I get down ever, I go look at the Time Warner building and I realized, gee, that wouldn't be there if it wasn't for me. I'm the one who negotiated that. Or I look at the reduction in the crime rates or the number of people off welfare or some of the great projects that we did along the Hudson River, and it makes it worth it. And there are a lot of people in politics like that. I had 45 Democrats and six Republicans in the city council, and I got most of my major legislation through. Not all, but most. I'd say 80%. How did I do that? Because I was fortunate enough to have a speaker named Peter Vallone, who was a good man, a smart man, and a moderate Democrat. A Democrat who can meet you in the middle. That didn't mean that I didn't have to give away some things that I didn't want to do to get stuff from him, from his members, that they didn't want to do. But it meant that we could have a bargain, you know, where I got a lot of what I wanted and had to give up a little. And I think that's, you know, I think that's the best politician is a politician that has a strong set of ideals, knows where they want to go, but then is willing to realize that you're not going to do that all in one step, that you're going to have to make compromises along the way to get a piece of it and then another piece and then another piece. And maybe you'll finally get all the way there because we're a democracy and everybody disagrees with each other.
Is there anything, Your Honor, in closing, is there anything that is gnawing at you? Is there anything that you'd really like to get done professionally? And that you haven't done it. I mean,
yes. I'm in the midst of doing it. I want to solve to the extent that you can the problem of cyber theft in America. I work with a company, LifeLock, that does private identity protection, and have helped them a lot in developing their security program. I work with three or four other companies that do cybersecurity. And I believe my big dream is to put together a much better approach to cybersecurity for businesses and then eventually for the government. But, you know, the businesses are going to figure it out because businesses have more resources and then give it to the government. Because, number one, cyber theft is the single largest form of theft right now that goes on in America. And cybersecurity is a danger to our national security. If you talk to the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, who is one of my assistant U.S. attorneys, by the way, he would tell you the biggest threat to America is the attack to our grid, the attack to our utilities, the trying to close down a city from North Korea or from somewhere in Afghanistan. Because of the fact that we have these hackers who can get in. Plus, people are getting knocked off through identity theft. I mean, every year it becomes millions and millions of people. So I have been working on it for a year. I am building a holistic approach to it. But it starts with the fact that people themselves should have identity theft protection. You no longer should just rely on the fact that nobody's going to take your... And it isn't your credit card so much. Everybody gets lulled into a sense of false security because the credit cards are insured. So if somebody gets your credit card and they use it, in most cases, it will cost you $50 and that's it. But if they get your Social Security number, they can go get your tax returns. And they can get your refund before you get it, or they can take out a student loan for one of your kids who doesn't need a student loan, or they can get you Social Security before you file for it, and then you go to file for it 2 or 3 years later, and they think you're a criminal. What I'm telling you happens hundreds and hundreds and millions of times.
It's an epidemic. I mean, it's serious. It's
an epidemic, and there are approaches to it. So, a company like LifeLock has, and there are a number of companies like it. I think LifeLock's the best, but there are a number of companies like it. They keep watch over your identity 24 hours a day. So I get a notification. I opened a bank account a few weeks ago. I get a notification. Is that you? Did you just open that bank account? And I just press on my iPhone, yes, that's me. If I had pressed no, as a friend of mine did about 3 weeks ago, somebody was trying to hack in to his Social Security account. So that's the basic protection. And then it gets more complicated than that. But that's one of my big dreams. My big dream for the United States is to see the United States turn around its foreign policy and go back on the offensive. America should lead the world. Russia shouldn't lead the world. China shouldn't lead the world. Iran shouldn't lead the Middle East. We shouldn't leave these vacuums. America should lead the world. And the President of the United States has to be willing to educate the American people that we need a very large military and that we do need presence in the Middle East, just like we had presence in Germany and still do in South Korea, because there's a threat to us. Mm. American military should be in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the places in the world in which people threaten us.
And let me just...
So I better run.
You got to run, and I appreciate your time. Mayor Rudy Giuliani has been our very special
Take
guest.
Take care, Frank.
Your Honor, okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Mayor Rudy Giuliani has been our very special guest. This is Frank McKay, but more importantly, the mayor, former mayor of New York City for 8 years, turned the city around, no question about it. Mayor Rudy Giuliani has been our very special guest. This is Frank McKay. We'll see you next time on Breaking It Down.